We're going to talk this morning about the idea of complaining and whether or not that is appropriate for us as Christians. But before we start talking about Christians and complaining and what we can do about that, I want to start this morning by doing kind of a quick survey, a summary of some of the experiences of the nation of Israel to kind of have a little bit of a backdrop in our minds of what we're talking about here when we think about being constant complainers. So it's interesting, if you will, open up your Bible to Exodus. We're going to start in the 14th chapter, and we're going to look at several passages in the book of Exodus and then several passages in the book of Numbers. And I'm going to go through them rather quickly as we try to illustrate this point about the characteristic that Israel was a grumbling and complaining people. So we'll notice in Exodus chapter 14, in verse 10, after they have left Egypt, that the armies of Pharaoh are pursuing them, and they are stuck between the Red Sea and the armies of Pharaoh. And in verse 10 of Exodus chapter 14, we read, as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. They became very frightened, so the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word which we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. They've just experienced and been carried through the 10 plagues and in a very miraculous way delivered out of Egypt. And the first time trouble comes, oh, why did you even take us out of Egypt? And of course, God delivers them through the Red Sea here, destroying the armies of Egypt. And we go over to the 15th chapter, and we read in verse 22 that then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they came to Marah, they couldn't drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, it's called Marah. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Of course, on this occasion, Moses casts the branch into the water and it becomes sweet and they can drink. But it's not very long and they're complaining and grumbling again. In the 16th chapter, beginning in verse 1, then they set out from Elim, and all the congregations of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month. They've barely been out of Egypt, but a month. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. And of course, God responds by giving them manna and quail to satisfy their hunger. But it's not very long, and they're again complaining about the fact that they have no water. In the 17th chapter, in verse 1, when all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? But the people thirsted for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, what shall I do to this people? A little more, and they'll stone me. You can see how the severity of their grumbling against Moses is ramping up here. And again, when they finally make it to Sinai and they see the presence of God descend down upon the mountain and speak to them from the cloud and the fire, and they're scared, and then Moses goes up on the mountain to intercede for them. Moses has been up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. And this is the response of the people we read in Exodus chapter 32, beginning in verse 1. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said, come, make us a god who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. And they're ready to turn around and go back to Egypt because Moses has been gone for 40 days. We don't know what's happening. Let's give up. Let's just go back. And again, a year later, as they're wandering in the wilderness, turn over to the book of Numbers. In Numbers chapter 11, we see them again complaining about the fact that they're tired of the manna. They want something more than the manna to eat. And we read in Numbers chapter 11, beginning in verse 1, "Now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. The people therefore cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. So the name of that place is called Terebah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them." And notice this, verse 4, "The rabble who were among them had greedy desires. And also the sons of Israel wept again and said, 'Who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we used to eat for free in Egypt, and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our appetite is gone. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna.'" Forget about the fact that the manna was miraculously provided for them and that they always had it. And had enough of it. And you jump down to the text of verse 16. "The Lord therefore said to Moses, 'Go for me, gather for me 70 men from the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and their officers, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand there with you. And I will come down and speak with you there, and I will take the spirit who's upon you, I'll put it upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you will not have to bear it all alone. Say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, Oh, that someone would give us meat to eat. For we were well off in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, Why did we ever leave Egypt?'" And of course, in the 12th chapter of Numbers, we have an incident where Miriam and Aaron, Moses' brother and sister, are complaining against Moses and saying, "Why do you get to be the only one who speaks for the Lord?" And the Lord punishes Miriam by giving her leprosy. We see even Moses' close companions, his brother and sister, are complaining about that. And of course, in the 13th chapter, in verse 31, the spies have gone into the land of Canaan. And they've come back and they've given a relatively good report. The land is flowing with milk and honey. It's got all this great produce. It's a beautiful place. It's a wonderful place. But the people of the land are really big, and we're afraid that we won't be able to defeat them. And so we read in verse 31, "But when the men who had gone up with him," that is with Caleb, "said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they're too strong for us.' So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There also we saw the Nephilim. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in their sight. And so we were in their sight.'" And of course, the congregation, in true form to their character at this point, what do? When they get this bad report, they complain. Chapter 14 and verse 1. "Then the congregation lifted up their voice and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to him, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?' And so they said to one another, 'Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt.'" And again, in the 16th chapter of Numbers, after Korah has raised his rebellion and challenged Aaron for the spot of the priesthood, and God has punished them. You remember on that occasion, Korah and all his people, the earth opened up and swallowed them alive. And a lot of people died. And notice the response of the rest of the congregation. In Numbers chapter 16 and verse 41, "But on the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, 'You are the ones who caused the death of the Lord's people.' And it came about when the congregation had assembled against Moses and Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Then Moses came to the front of the tent of the meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them instantly.' And of course, they fell on their faces. They're intimidated by the presence of God, and the plague goes out among the people, and Aaron has to take his censer and go and stand between the living and the dead to check the plague that God sends against them for their grumbling and their complaining and their rebellion. And if that wasn't bad enough, when we get to Numbers chapter 21, we read in verse 4 and 5, that then they went out from Mount Hor by way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom. They're almost done with wandering in the wilderness. They're getting ready to go into the promised land, but they have to travel around Edom rather than going through. And what does it say? The people became impatient because of the journey. And the people spoke against God and Moses and said, "Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food." Now, we could go on and on and on looking at the nation of Israel and how they always constantly complained about every little hiccup in the road. And nothing was ever good enough for them. And it was always misery, and it was always doom, and it was always gloom. But real quick, I want to make an observation about a huge danger that I think we see illustrated here by the nation of Israel. And that is, they were so focused on the negative, on the hardships, on the trials, on the inconveniences, that they failed to see all of the blessings that they had received. I mean, it blows my mind that they keep saying, "Oh, I wish we were just back in Egypt." And the way they somehow look back at Egypt and think, it was so wonderful back in Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt. "Oh, but we got food for free." Was it really free? You're a slave. That's not free. But all they could see was the negative in the present, and it made them fail to appreciate the great blessings that they had received. You know, when they left Egypt, they actually plundered the Egyptians. After the 10 plagues, you go back and read in Exodus chapter 12, after the death of the firstborn, the Egyptians were like paying them to get out of Dodge. "Please leave. Whatever you want, we'll give it. You want gold, you want money, you want garments, just take it and go." And the text says that the Israelites plundered the Egyptians. Usually you only plunder somebody after you defeat them in war. And they're just saying, "We'll pay you to get out of here." And of course, they forget about the deliverance of at the Red Sea, where God stands between them and the armies of Egypt. And then they cross through on the Red Sea on dry land. And when the Egyptians try, God swallows them up and destroys the armies of Egypt. And they forget about the great victory that they won over the Amalekites. You remember on that instance when Moses was up on the hill watching over the battle and he had to hold his arms up, and whenever his arms began to sink lower, then the Israelites would start losing. But when he raised his arms up, they would begin to win. And so they got a stone for Moses to sit on, and Aaron and Joshua held up Moses' hands so that the Israelites would be victorious. But they forgot about that. And they forgot about the manna. They forgot about the quail. They forgot about the time that the water came from the rock and the time that God took the bitter water and made it sweet. They forgot about all of this stuff. They didn't see any of the good because they were so focused on the negative. All they could see was the bad. And yet God again and again demonstrated to them that He was with them, that He would protect them, that He would provide for them, that He would lead them, that He would give them rest, if only they would listen to Him and trust in Him and follow His lead and obey Him. But they were so focused on the negative, they were so preoccupied with complaining, that they failed to trust in the Lord. And ultimately, that was their demise. We read in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 19, regarding that whole generation that came out of Egypt. The Hebrew writer says, "So we see that they were not able to enter," that is, enter into the promised land, "because of unbelief." They didn't trust in God. And I have to think that a big part of why they didn't trust in God was because they were such complainers. They were so consumed with seeing the negative and complaining about everything that they couldn't even trust in God, even though He time and again proved that He would take care of them. So I guess the question that I want us to think about this morning, though, is not to be critical of the Israelites, but to think about ourselves. How do you respond to hardship? How do you respond to difficulties, to trials, to unpleasant events in your life? Well, unfortunately, too many people respond exactly the way the Israelites did. They complain and they complain and they complain. They grumble about their circumstances. And they'll usually grumble and complain to anyone and everyone who will listen to them. But the question that I have for us, though that may be true of people in the world, is that how a Christian should respond to hardship, to trials, to bad events and bad circumstances in our lives? Is that how we ought to respond to these types of situations? And of course, somebody wants to point out real quick that there is precedent in the New Testament to weep with those who weep, right? Romans chapter 12 and verse 15. And so we ought to be able to cry and weep, and that we actually ought to share with our brethren in that. Right? Just as we might rejoice with those who rejoice, we're also to weep with those who weep. Or in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 26, the Apostle Paul says, If one member suffers, all the members suffer with him. And if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. And so we see within the body that there is supposed to be this sharing of both positive feelings and also some negative feelings. But let me suggest to you that in these contexts where we're told to weep with those who weep and to suffer with those who suffer, the weeping and the suffering here is not the same thing as grumbling and complaining about things. You know, the reality is that weeping and suffering in these contexts, I think he's referring to that kind of natural response that we have when we are maybe blindsided by some tragic event in our life. Or maybe it's a significant loss that we experience. Right? It's like if you lose your job, if you go into work and you've had this stellar work record and you've been a great employee all these years, and you go into work one day and they say, "Sorry, we're letting you go." Talk about taking the wind out of your sails, right? And that's certainly going to put in place some difficulties. What am I going to do about paying the rent? What am I going to do about getting food for my family or paying these medical bills or whatever the case may be? And so it may be stressful, right? Somebody in your family unexpectedly comes down with this crazy illness and they lose their mind. And they die. That stinks. You want to weep over those things. And that's natural, to be saddened by those kinds of events. And certainly, as the writer of Ecclesiastes said, that there's a time for everything. There indeed is a time to weep and a time to laugh. There's a time to mourn and a time to dance. So it's not like, as Christians, you can never be sad about something. But being sad about something is not the same as grumbling and complaining about something. And certainly, even when we think about weeping and mourning and suffering, that ought not to be what characterizes the children of God. There is no place in the child of God's life to wallow in self-pity. That's not a luxury that's been granted to us. By all accounts, that's the easy thing to do. It's easy to throw a pity party. It's easy to feel bad for yourself. It's easy to complain about things rather than to try to do something proactive. That's easy. But that's not a luxury that children of God have. We're not supposed to be complainers who constantly complain about our lives and our circumstances in life. In fact, it's interesting to me that the idea of complaining and grumbling especially when you look in the New Testament. We've illustrated clearly from the Old Testament that grumbling and complaining is a negative attribute. But even when you look at the New Testament, I'm struggling to come up with passages where grumbling and complaining are portrayed in a positive light. You know, the Pharisees grumbled against Jesus and his disciples. Oh, it's not something that we are to aspire to do. I'm a good grumbler. I'm a good complainer. That's not something we're just shooting for. In fact, for the child of God, it ought to be the opposite of that. We don't want to be grumblers and complainers. Far from being, you know, the negative Nancys or the Debbie Downers who are always kind of bringing everything down a notch by talking about the latest calamity that's happened. You know, we as Christians need to have a positive outlook on our lives. We need to be optimistic people. Yeah, but you don't understand, Josh. You don't understand how bad I have it. You don't understand how much I've had to endure. You don't understand how hard my life really is. My life has been so hard. I have so many trials. I've endured and I've been subjected to so many different kinds of injustices and mistreatments over the years. I've always gotten the short end of the stick. You just don't understand. And though I might have to admit that I can't always relate to constantly having the short end of the stick or being subjected to ill treatment for years and years and years, the reality is that it doesn't matter. That's the hard truth. Unfortunately, it doesn't matter how bad your life has been. It doesn't matter what you've gone through. It doesn't matter what you're going through. Because even in hardships, Christians are to have positive attitudes. Even when suffering trials and persecution. Paul says in Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 3, after he's talked about the hope that we have received as children of God and the fact that we can exult, that we can rejoice, that we can glory in that, he says, and not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations. You exult, you glory, you rejoice in your tribulations? How could that be, Paul? How could you feel positive about mistreatment, about hardships, about negative circumstances? Well, Paul says, knowing that the tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance brings about proven character, and proven character, it brings about hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us. Paul could rejoice in tribulations. He could exult in those hardships in his life because he knew what that would bring about, what could be achieved through those negative circumstances. That we have to sometimes make it through those difficulties in order to build that spiritual muscle. You're never going to gain endurance by sitting on the couch. You got to get out and run. You got to go through the hardship in order to build that muscle. And Paul says here that our perseverance, it will bring about the proven character. And when we know what we're made of, when we know what our faith is all about, and we know it's strong because we've endured, that gives us great reason to hope for what will be given to us, that ultimate rest in the end. James puts it slightly differently in James chapter 1, beginning in verse 3, where he says there, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials." And it's interesting, he leaves that pretty open-ended. What's included in various trials, James? Well, just various trials. You name it, it would fit in there. But again, notice James isn't just saying, well, we'd be giddy about the fact that we're going through a trial. Woohoo, this is a great trial I'm going through. No, it's because we're looking to see what that trial can do in it, do in us, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result so that you'll be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. You see, we can have a positive outlook on the difficulties of our life because we know what positive things can come out of that. Because we know that if we will face those trials with a positive attitude, putting our trust in God, that He can cause all things to work out well for those who love Him. And we'll be better for it on the other end. But you know, it's interesting to me that it's not that we should avoid complaining when we're encountering various trials. It's not that we need to remain positive only because of the positive results that it can bring about in our lives, but also because of the way God will look upon us when we do endure trials in a positive way. Notice in 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 18. Peter here speaking to servants, he says, "Be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable." He's talking to guys, to Christians here in this context, who are being unreasonably treated by their masters. It's not fair. It's not right. They don't deserve to be treated the way that they're being treated. But he says this: be submissive to them, act right, for this, verse 19, for this finds favor. If for the sake of conscience towards God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. God looks favorably upon people who, even though they don't deserve that kind of treatment, even though they are, it's unjust what's happening to them, they bear up under that and they carry that load and they say, I'm going to keep doing what's right. God looks favorably upon that individual. I'll tell you what, even if we didn't gain any other positive thing for ourselves out of enduring joyfully persecution, to know that God, the creator of the universe, is looking down on me and he says, Josh, I like that about you. Now, to me, that means a lot. To think that my heavenly Father would look down on me and say, your actions find favor in my sight. It means a lot. But notice this. He goes on in verse 20 and he says, for what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? Well, that's a rhetorical question. There is no credit for you. When you do the wrong thing and you're being punished for that, and you patiently endure it, you got what you deserved. You better patiently endure it. Well, I think that's the point here, because he goes on and says, but if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. So I think Peter's point here is, if we're called upon to graciously endure unjust ill treatment, then you better graciously endure just punishment for your own wrongdoings. So again, for the Christian, it doesn't really matter what your circumstances are. It doesn't matter whether you deserve the ill treatment or whether it's unjust. You're to respond positively to those circumstances in your life. Which is probably why later on in this same letter, in 1 Peter chapter 4, in verse 15, Peter will remind the brethren, he says, make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a troublesome meddler. Make sure that you aren't doing the wrong thing and then having to suffer for that. But, verse 16, if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. And if you jump back in the text just a few verses to verse 12, you again see emphasize the attitude that we're supposed to have when we are encountering various trials. He says, "Beloved, don't be surprised at the fire or ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you're reviled for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you." That's the attitude that Christians are supposed to have about negative circumstances in their life, whether just or unjust. We're to be positive about it. And so you say to yourself, okay, I get it. I know that that's how I'm supposed to act. We're not supposed to complain. We're supposed to have a positive outlook on life. That's what we're supposed to do. But let's be honest. That's not who we always are. The reality is that we do complain. And we know brethren who complain. Maybe even a lot. All of us, at some point or another, has thrown a pity party for ourselves. We have demonstrated a tendency to complain about our lot in life. So the question is, what do we do about that? What do I do when I see someone, a brother or a sister, who is complaining all the time about their circumstances, about their life? And maybe even more importantly, what do I do if I'm the one who's always complaining about everything? What can we do? Well, let's tackle the more personal one first. If it's you, or if it's me, I think the first thing that we need to do is we need to have a paradigm shift. We need to change the way we look at things. And we need to start intentionally looking at things from a more positive perspective. And so whenever something happens to us that's undesirable, instead of asking, why is this happening to me? We need to change the way we phrase that question and think about that question. And instead of thinking about it in a grumbling and complaining tone of voice, we need to ask it, why is this happening to me? What am I supposed to be learning from this? Where do I need to grow? Where do I need to make adjustments in my life? What is this trial trying to teach me about who I am and what I need to be more like my God? And so instead of looking at it from a negative standpoint, why is it always happening to me? We need to look more introspectively and think, what can I do differently? What is this event in my life trying to help me? What is God trying to help me see from this event in my life? And I think that when we start looking at our trials and hardships more as faith-building exercises rather than drudgery that we have to endure, we're going to start having a better attitude about them. We're going to complain about things a whole lot less, and we're going to actually grow and mature in our faith, and in the end, we're going to be better off for it. And secondly, I would suggest to you that another thing that we need to do is we need to keep our eye on the prize. We need to remember that this moment is not the end all of everything. That there is something greater waiting for those who are children of God after this life is over. And so even if I don't ever see any benefit in this life by having to endure these hardships, these trials, this mistreatment, at the very least, I need to have the attitude that Paul expressed in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning in verse 16, where he says, "Therefore, do not lose heart. But though our outer man is decaying, our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal." Paul is saying, keep your eye on heaven. and that'll help you to have a more positive attitude. And I think thirdly, another thing that we can do to help us be more positive and optimistic is to practice thanksgiving in our lives. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, in verse 16, Paul says, "Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus." I don't think that it's a sheer coincidence that he says, "Rejoice always," and then follows that up with, "Pray to God and give thanks to Him." You know, the reality is that when you are thinking and contemplating and trying to verbalize the things in your life that you are thankful for, it's really, really hard to complain about bad things. So I think those are some things that we can do if you're the one, if I'm the one who's struggling with being a complainer. Change the way I look at things, keep my eye on the prize, and practice thanksgiving. But what if it's somebody else? Is there anything that we can do to help others who might be struggling with this? You know, my first inclination and what I want to do when I see somebody else complaining all the time, and I do this with my kids all the time when they're complaining, I'm like, "Knock it off! Stop complaining!" It's not that easy. It would be nice if it worked that way. But the reality is as somebody who is a chronic complainer, you got to recognize this. It's a habit. It's a bad habit. It's a terrible habit, but it is a habit nonetheless. And just like every other habit that we form over our lives, habits aren't formed overnight. And so if someone has developed over time a habit of complaining about their lot in life, you can't expect that that's going to change overnight. You can't break habits overnight. It takes time to break habits. And so therefore, I would suggest to you that we need to be patient with one another. In Ephesians chapter 4, Paul talked about the idea that we are to, he's imploring us to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which we've been called. And in verse 2, he says some things that are going to be included in that, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing tolerance to one another in love. We need to be patient with one another. We need to show tolerance to one another. Now, this doesn't mean that we simply tolerate the bad behavior, that we turn a blind eye to it and act like it's not happening. Okay? We need to try to encourage and teach, and in some cases, maybe even have to reprove and discipline a brother or sister who's not acting like a Christian, that's not walking in a manner worthy. But it needs to be with patience that we do that. You know, we certainly need to bear one another's burdens, right? Galatians chapter 6, verse 2, Paul says, "Bear one another's burdens and thereby fulfill the law of Christ." Well, I think part of this idea of bearing one another's burdens is found in verse 1, where he says, "Brethren, even if any is caught in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness." If somebody's struggling with constantly complaining about everything all the time, sometimes it is in fact appropriate and part of bearing their burden to help them overcome that, to restore them in a spirit of gentleness. But notice the second part of verse 1 where Paul says, "Each one looking to yourself so that you too will not be tempted." And here's something, especially in the context of trying to help somebody who's a complainer overcome that. When you're trying to help somebody who's a chronic complainer, don't fall into the trap of complaining about their chronic complaining. Look to yourself so that you too are not tempted. Because that's a real likelihood. It wears on us. We saw that with Moses on a couple occasions. He turns to God and says, "What are you going to do about these people? They're driving me nuts." Well, God does do some things for Moses over time that helps him to bear that burden. We read about one of those where he took the spirit that was on Moses and put it on those elders to help him bear that burden. Okay? But let's not fall into that trap. Let's be patient. Let's, as the individual is working to overcome that bad habit in their life, let's be patient with them. And let's bear with them as they come along, as they try to make improvements. But I think a second thing that we can do is that we can model positive attitudes in front of them. You know, it's like we read a couple weeks ago in Romans chapter 12 and verse 21, don't be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Right? You want to short circuit somebody who's complaining about everything? Start being super positive around them. Overcome that negative, that evil inclination with a positive, with a good one. Right? And so I think that that's something that we need to do more and more. And we see a couple examples of this. And I thought about Jethro because I was thinking about the Israelites. This is Moses' father-in-law. Notice in Exodus chapter 18, when his father-in-law meets him, and we read in verse 8 of Exodus 18 that Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake and all the hardship that had befallen them on the journey and how the Lord had delivered them. Moses sees his father-in-law. I haven't seen him in a while. He says, man, this has been, God's done a lot of great things. Don't get me wrong. It's been a rough road, though. And notice Jethro's response, verse 9. Jethro rejoiced over all the goodness which the Lord God had done to Israel in delivering them from the hands of the Egyptians. So Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh, and who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when he dealt proudly against the people. And then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses' father-in-law before God. I love it. Jethro shows up on the scene. He sees Moses is a little bit discouraged and downtrodden over all this hardship that he's been having to deal with these complaining people. And Jethro's response is, that is amazing. God is good. God is more powerful than anybody. Look at all the great things God has done. Let's worship God. And that's exactly what they did. And I can imagine that that was a shot in the arm for Moses. Lifted his spirits. Of course, in the New Testament, we see a character by the name of Barnabas who's very similar. He's an encourager to people. We read in Acts chapter 11, beginning in verse 20. I'm going to skim here just a little bit. Some people have come and preached the gospel in Antioch of Syria, and many people turned to the Lord. In verse 22, we read, the news about them reached the ears of the church at Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas off to Antioch. And notice what Barnabas does when he arrives. He witnessed the grace of God. He sees the great things that God is doing, and what does he do? He rejoiced. And he began to encourage them all with resolute heart to remain true to the Lord, for he was a good man and full of the Holy Spirit and faith, and considerable numbers were brought to the Lord. Barnabas shows up, and what does he do? He begins to rejoice. And I would suggest to you that one of the ways in which he was able to encourage the people and to help so many come to the Lord is because of his nature of being a positive, encouraging influence on those around him. In fact, that's what his name means, Barnabas. That's actually not his real name. His real name is Joseph. Barnabas was a nickname that was given to him by the apostles, and Barnabas means son of encouragement. He earned that name because of the kind of good, godly man that he was. And he was happy and he was rejoicing and he was being a positive influence on those around him. His positivity rubbed off on the people around him. He was an encourager. And we need to try to be like these men. We need to be like Barnabas and like Jethro. We need to be positive and encouraging to our brethren. We need to set an example of rejoicing always and doing things without grumbling or complaining ourselves. And perhaps our positivity will rub off on them, and they themselves will be encouraged to have a more positive attitude about their lives. But recognize this. Ultimately, if someone else is going to change, the change has to come from within them. You cannot change someone else. As much as you want to grab somebody and shake them and say, wake up! Start acting right! It doesn't work that way. Ultimately, we're all responsible for ourselves. If you go back there to Galatians chapter 6, after he told us to bear one another's burdens, he goes on in verse 3 and says, "But if anyone thinks he's something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. But each one must examine his own works, and then he will have reason for boasting in regard to himself alone and not in regard to another, for each one will bear his own load." Ultimately, we're each responsible for ourselves. And so though we cannot change anyone else if they don't want to change, we can certainly try to encourage them. We can try to be a positive influence around them, to encourage them to do what's right, to try our best to model in front of them positive attributes. And maybe we'll rub off on them. So what I want to encourage us to do this morning is to be a positive people. And let's see if our positivity can't rub off on those who are negative around us.